switch on.
Right. Okay, still good morning, isn't it? So, going to take a slightly different approach to best practice. Hexwar, we're mainly digital, but 90% of the things I wish to cover all our games. It's not just a digital thing. Myself, I've been a war game forever. Play every day. For 20 years, I insisted I play my own games at least 1 hour a day to be like a user. Just play more games. The message that was out, if you don't play games socially, please start doing it. It's very important to do. But I've got a background which massively influences my game design and my attitudes to PME. I was head of marketing research of Dell Computer Corporation. That drove a factor by which if you can't measure it, don't do it. It's an approach we took in business. You can argue you can't apply it to everything, but find a way to measure success. Find a way to know that what you're doing is working. I've also worked for a gambling company. Now, the gambling company massively changed my attitude because in gambling, there's a massive amount of research about what drives user choices. Why do we do what we do? So it's good stuff to read. And performance in gambling is very similar to performance of your players in PME. I've done a variety of other things, but for over 20 years, my main activity has been trying to drive Hexwar games, mainly consumer, and we were only consumer and trying to wind it down in 2017 when US Marine Corps said we were using those games. So we're here in the PME field. Okay, my concern is how has gaming changed over the years? What did board games deliver that they didn't deliver in the 1980s? Are there any differences in how we use board games? We play different games and different mechanics, but what's really changed? Are we focused on what the players do, then why they do it, and understanding why they do what they do? And I assure you, there was a gap in our field in that between the fact that what players tell you they learn and what they learn is not the same things. Oh, I should have mentioned, I did my first PME game in 1978, Manchester University, with David Chandler. He was a visiting lecturer. 32 of us, all in different rooms. It was lots of fun. Okay, so what do we do differently with the US Marine Corps? It's digital, it's remote. We can do solo games, competitions. We'll see more on that. We play duplicate. I think that's very important. Lots of replay, lots of analytics. And most of all, we get an awful lot of people. Okay, digital. You play faster, you learn faster. You don't have to read the rules. The computer will mean you won't make a terrible mistake that ruins a whole training session. And if players in PME games have their game ruined by a lack of understanding of the rules, they will not learn the lesson you're trying to get across. So, hit the buttons. Remote. The advantage of the way we do things with the Marine Corps is remote play. You can play from anywhere. You can play when you want, where you want. It's got an awful lot going for it. We can also play against the AI. Digital's got the advantage as well, and this is the future, and we can run our games headless, and we can put the data and into educating an AI to eventually play our games and give us even more lessons. Competition. I don't think too many play their games competitively. But with the US Marine Corps, competitive play means the players bring their A game. They're focused. The results are all published online. If a lieutenant colonel plays a corporal, that's online to see. We've had one instance of a general playing a private. Okay, so it's great, and it drives everybody's game quality much more higher. Okay, so we have ranking tables, best in groups. You can look how your class is doing against a different class. You can see who's the best of all the majors. You can look at it any way you want. Duplicate. Duplicate play is a very important basis if you're playing games. Applies in bridge. But duplicate for us is that you play red and blue. Games where you only play one side, you get an incorrect, an invalid profile in your risk analysis. People's view of the game changes. So let's take a simple example of loss. In fact, no. I'll come to it in a moment, actually. It's on another slide. Sorry. Out of sequence. My apologies. Okay, replay. We can play a game from any point. Players can go back and look step by step by step through the game. What happened? Where did it go wrong? They can discuss that with the team leaders or whoever's leading the group. Analytics, can't say it enough. The simplest one we do in the games is just a heat map showing you where all your guys died. And the most common thing we see in the games is all these little clusters of people around bridges and around road junctions killed by artillery. Yeah? Or we do loss tables telling you how many of your units were killed while mounted. In a world of drones, get out of the vehicle. We're trying to teach people these practical things. So that comes through the analytics. But we have mega analytics. Play one small game and you'll get over 100,000 data points. We're recording all of the choices you could have made and didn't make. We can go into incredible depth, but we do not give that back to the individual players. That's introducing task saturation. Audience and volume. The numbers of players we can get to are vast. The numbers of games we get played are in the tens of thousands. The benefits of learning through just sheer volume of play are fantastic within that. Okay, so didn't want that one. Right. But let's take a slight angle as to what's different between doing games digitally and the way we play and really the influences of how people really play war games. If you've never been to this website, the Decision Lab, I suggest you do have a good look. It's a fantastic website explaining how and why people make decisions. Let's take this, the decision-making pyramid. So we got there that you would think that most people will make the decisions in your games based on carefully evaluated rational profile. They'll go, I need to attack here, or I need to help out in Ethiopia over here. But we don't, okay? That's what you want them to do, and that's what they actually do. The majority of decisions during games are based on gut feel. Here it says random coin flips. It's whatever is the effect in the game. Player decision making is not the rational decision making you think they have. Okay, that's because of heuristics and cognitive bias. So what within cognitive bias, what's the sort of thing that makes me make a decision here and now? Okay, and if you've got older players like me, it'll be more of an example. So an example of cognitive bias would be the fact that I also do consultancy and marketing on the internet occasionally, and I have to make my judgment based on my experiences in the 1990s with Dell Computer Corporation. The problem with that is like a surgeon making a decision on surgery on a methodology that went out of date in 1996. We've got to move forward and change how we look at things. So, let's go forward. Right. Cognitive dissonance. That would be MacArthur in Korea during Incheon and after Incheon, sorry, before when the Chinese turn up. It's the denial of the facts as they really are. You can call it your interpretation of your alternative facts or whatever. But cognitive dissonance is where you go against the facts and the reality and make an irrational decision. It's normal human behavior. You cannot get it out of your games, but within your game design, you want to be able to recognize that people are going against the flow, part of the planning, part of the analytics. Right, so you can't avoid it, it's normal, be clear. Right, a regular thing for those who've seen me present before, dice, hate dice. I hate any way that we're presenting randomness as choices to players. This is normal, we all do this. If you think that you're some super analyst and you'll work out the proper odds on the go, you don't. When you're playing games, you make your heuristic decisions, your assessments. You do not do the calculation that of rolling three dice, needing four or more on a single dice, and I can roll one, two, or three dice, is either 50% on one dice, 75% on two, or 83% on three. You actually make a decision that it's two is twice and three is treble. That's what you do. That's what your players are doing. They are not making rational decisions on the use of luck in your games. So you need to find something in your designs that help them understand the real odds, the real problem. Presenting things as percentages is a good step in that direction. But presenting things where, oh, we'll have two six-sided dice, two eight-sided dice, and two ten-sided dice. There is no rational analysis, understanding by the players going on there. Now, just to reiterate, if any of you disagree with anything I'm saying, please refer to this slide, okay? Because that's where you are, okay? Like it or no, there's a ton of research to support this, and it's not just about games, it's in business, it's in decision making in general. Right, so dopamine. Your players, when they're playing your games, if they're engaged, are generating dopamine. Rolling dice generates more. Taking a risk, that generates plenty more. So players go, well, I've only got a low chance, it's 1 in 10. That's more dopamine, I'll go for that for some more. So they're more likely to do it. But you don't want them doing that in real life, so get it out of your game design. Think of your design that you don't generate this excitement, this unnecessary decision-making in the game. The most common one that's not understood is a near-miss event. If your players need a 6 to get an objective, and they roll a 5, that generates dopamine of a near-miss event. They will now generally attempt to roll a 6 again. Yet the player who then wanted to get a 6 but rolled a 1, well, he had a big miss. So generally the players who rolled a 1 in response to needing a 6 are less likely to repeat the failed attempt again. Dopamine. Loss aversion. An interesting contradiction. This is normal behavior in business. It's not just about war games where we kill stuff. Okay, in any event where you have an even chance, that have an even chance whereby I can either kill one of these guys or I can lose one of my guys. That's choice one. But choice two is, wow, I could do a high risk event. And high risk event is that what I'll do is, oh, I'll attack, but it might go terribly wrong this time and I'll lose 10 units, but I might win. The majority of players giving an even chance event will actually do nothing. But the majority of players where there's an alternative high risk event will choose the high risk event. Strange contradiction. There is tons of analytics to support this. There's tons of research to perform this. This applies if you make an investment in building an aircraft carrier. It's a reality of us, but you need to recognize it, measure it, and get it out of the game. Sunk cost fallacy. Everybody knows about sunk cost fallacy. We're very good at it in Scotland, where I live, investing in ferries that cost 10 times the original budget, kept putting money in. It's very common in defense contracts, is it not? It happens in your games all the time, in that the players invested some time and effort to achieve a goal and hasn't got that goal. So what do they do? Do they write off a loss, or do we actually invest even more money and time? Well, the majority of people invest more money and time, some cost. Normal human behavior. Recognize it, get it out of the game. Provide us feedback. One of the ways you can get it out of the game, for example, is agreeing in the planning stage exactly how much will we spend? Where's the red line? Or how many times will we attack? Where's the red line? But actually seeing it happen during the games when there's been no thought about it is an error. You need to put it in for game design. Monte Carlo fallacy doesn't just apply in Monte Carlo. It's this belief that a six is due. Red is due. Yeah? It's normal in all the games. Let's take an example of how people do that. Just watch. I've watched hundreds and hundreds of games. Okay? Just watch people. And if you've got dice in the game, again, I use dice as an example. If it, cards are just as bad. In fact, cards are quite often worse. Anything by that. And that applies whether it's just the white player issuing cards. Okay? It's a random event that a player doesn't understand. But where is dice? They need to roll sixes. And there'll be a good percentage of people will only find the dice that do not have sixes on them. Because it's due a six, you see. And there's another group. Look at all the dice which have got sixes on them. And they pick all the ones with the sixes up because they need to roll the damn six. Because they think it's time for six. Or that dice is good at rolling sixes. This weird, stupid behaviour is normal in PME games. And we do not want it. It arrives at decisions which are neither rational nor belong to the goal or learning objective of the game. But it's there all the time. Unnecessary risk. Back to where it was on duplicate. If you analyse or are able to get the analytics on your games, you'll see as players are failing to achieve their objective, they increase their risk profile. Well, we don't really want them doing that in real life, do we? But if players are actually achieving their objective and doing well, they've got something to play with. So they increase their risk profile. So in most games, when you're able to analyse the data, your players are increasing their risk profile in games where you do not want them to increase their risk profile. So what we do with the Marine Corps is to get a ranking, and all the tournaments are played duplicate. You play red and blue in every game, and we put the combination of the scores together. The result of that is if you're winning a game, and it's going okay, you wind down the operation, you don't take unnecessary risks. If you're losing a game, well, I'm going to try and lose it better than the other guy. So I'm going to shut down the operation. I'm going to withdraw from a battlefield. But most PMA games I've observed, and I've observed hundreds, the players play to destruction, which is not what we want in real life, and this is not what we want them to do in our games. So duplicate is a big benefit. Easy with computers, I agree on that one. Okay, so to finish, two more quickies on heuristics. There's tons of them, by the way. If you read online, there's hundreds of heuristics. You can go forever. But there's association. People make association. So if you play your games in a room where there's maybe six or eight tables, don't put them too close to each other. Yeah. If anything, try not to not even talk to each other. Because what will happen in a game, let's take Classic Ivy's Arnhem. We need to roll six to get to capture Arnhem. Now, that six is a lot, but it's an easy one to do. Now, having your plan based on the fact I have to roll a six to capture Arnhem is not a good plan. Find a better way than one in six. But if one table does it and succeeds, and yes, we've done a bit of dopamine, got hands in the air, the tables around them will often then try to replicate the behaviour. Okay? That if somebody else can achieve an unlikely event, then I can achieve it too. That's what happens. But you find that out from analytics. The hot hand fallacy, we've all seen this. The players had a good run of luck. So they will now play on the basis that they will have a good run of luck. That is not a rational way to play a game, but it's what they do. So you need to think of a way to get them to recognise it, that it's in the game. It could be me. Am I good on time? Good? Just check. This is last slide number, so you're okay. So it could be me. Those of us in the UK are probably here, the National Lottery use it, could be me. Okay, you've got yourself a 1 in 28 million chance of it could be me, so it's not much of a chance. But in any game, and let's take a card game, where there is the silver bullet card that I will win the game, that a person could give me. I assure you that many of your players will be running a little bit of dopamine when you turn the cards to think, it could be me. I could get that card. I'm going to build my strategy on getting that card. It is irrational, but this irrational decision making takes place in your games, whether you think they do or do not do that. It's there all the time. So try not to have silver bullet type things in your games. Nemesis, I've already done. Suggestion. I've done, but an example of a game is if you do a briefing on a game and you explain what happened in previous games, that can heavily influence the decisions of the players in the game. I'm going to have to make a gambling example because it's an easy one. If you've ever watched the lotteries being drawn, the people organising the lotteries go, oh, number six, and the number six hasn't appeared for 7 weeks. So what becomes the next most popular number chosen the following day? It's number six, because number six is now due. Yeah? But we've planted that seed in their mind. We've done it to them. If you bring up these unusual events in your game briefing, oh, somebody was lucky and he took Arnhem, they'll try and replicate that lucky event. So you have to be very wary about it. But there's a contradiction. In the national lotteries, they then also go, oh, number seven. Number seven's not been seen for 7 weeks. And now the number seven becomes it's the opposite. It didn't appear. But now the number seven becomes very important. Now, that seeding of information, how you debrief games, influences the decision-making of the players in an irrational way. It's not their plan, it's not their choice, but it's what happens. So, and the final one is the one... Also, the illusion control, my apologies. The illusion control is a player feels that they have some control over the cards in the game, or the die rolling in the game, or the events in the game. So an example of that might be that if you take Littoral Commander, which you are doing digitally, you've got cards in the game, and a player thinks, well, oh, I've got the best choice of my 5 points or 10 points. And that influences their decision-making because they think they've got a better draw than the other player. But it's based on point system, which mainly means if I spend 10 points and if he's got 10 points, it's a pretty even bet between the two of us. It is not the fact they've not been given any advantage in the game at all. They've just been given a different thing to do. So the illusion of control, you need to try and avoid that the players think they have some control of the game. Oh, but if you ever do gambling and press any of those buttons on the machines, they don't do anything. Okay, they just tell you they can... do stuff. That's the illusion of control. But the worst one, by far, is in PME games, is the influence of disengaged players. Particularly now it's die rolling time. Okay, I have lost count of a number of times I've heard go for it at die rolling time by the guy who 2 minutes ago was on his mobile phone. Okay? But the unengaged players make comments which seed all those other things I put in, their suggestions, which are not valid to the rational interpretation of the game. So to finish, I would ask everybody to pay just the attention to this and accept that that is the reality of the balance of decision making in your games. Your players at the end will give you a nice, rational reason for their strategy and their decisions and their risk-taking. They think they're in the orange box, but they're not. Thank you very much.